morning show, Sports at 590 The Fan. Vic never misses, eh? He hits those tunes. He's listening.
He misses all the time. He's literally...
He's always
he misses
working.
All the time. Miss, miss, miss.
I love it.
Like, hey, Vic, can you get this? He's like, no.
I think he's
hitting. Hey, Vic, can you just... No.
The lie detector test determined that was a lie.
See? Look at
he's
him
in
go.
Control. He's in control. That's not fair.
Speaking of misses.
Fake news.
Ooh. The Raptors in a close game last night against the Heat. No Kyle Lowry, but they did have quite the run there. It was close, it was tight. That Scottie Barnes toss into the stands, that was an anxious moment as a fan.
Poor Matt but Devlin, like, almost fainted.
Yeah, I mean, that I thought that was at least an actual like flagrant foul. Like, I thought it was pretty aggressive. I don't know what your thoughts were on that, but yeah, a game of quite some highs and lows. Blake, what do we take from, you know, maybe the biggest positive leaving that game?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest positive continues to be Pascal Siakam. I think you know, another 10 assist game. I think, you know, you look at how that game played out, and it's not particularly surprising, right? The Heat are good, they're tough. They're a defense-first team. They got Bam back in this one, which obviously supercharges their defense. And the Raptors are going to continue to struggle to score in the half court. And the Fred VanVleet dynamic was emblematic of that in the first half. After he had been averaging, I think, under a turnover a game over the last 10, he comes in, he has 4 in the first half. And it's like, okay, well, what's different? He had the ball in his hands a little bit more. Miami uses their length super well to keep point guards from passing. Jimmy Butler's all over him. But then as they start to come back and as things start to look a little better, what does it look like? Well, it's once again, the ball's in Pascal Siakam's hands. Fred VanVleet's, you know, he started the game flying around off ball. He had 3 threes basically in the, like, right away. You catched your Fred VanVleet threes prop. And then he had a couple more late. And it continues to be what we've talked about. And it's that this team's going to struggle in the half court. But when they're at their best, it's going to be the ball in Siakam's hands and Fred playing off the ball a little bit more. And it doesn't have to be that way for the whole game, but in the key moments and for the higher volume, that's how it's probably going to look. Siakam didn't have the most efficient scoring game, but 10 assists to 0 turnovers, and you add in 5 steals. JD, I know you were worried. He hit the rebound over too. Checked all the boxes. I think just Siakam's continued growth as a playmaker is, you know, the story with this team right now.
Shout out to JD, who said to get the assist prop yesterday when we were doing our betting segment. That hit real early. I should have done the, I think we did, what, 7 or more assists? Could have done the 10 or more assists for extra bank. So
yeah,
keep an eye on that one.
Yeah, we juiced it up from, I think the over-under was 5.5, but you were losing money on it. But the 7 or more was plus 300. So
yeah.
Easy money.
Nice little bet builder night on the Raps Heat game. I think that's bidding. That's the big thing right now is Siakam is really, really coming into his own as a playmaker. And, you know, we can continue to read the stats and update them every game. And I know you guys joked yesterday. I was like, well, it's just 10 games. Like, we got to be careful. And, like, now it's just 11 games. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, it's 7 assists per game. It's again, to update the stats, 24, 10, and 7 over the last 11, basically, and doing so pretty efficiently. So Siakam continues to be the story for me. And then big picture, the team just doesn't have the scoring punch to, you know, their defense is going to keep them in games, but when it gets grimy like this one, they just don't have the score.
So there's a few things for me. One is just, I really, like, Siakam is changing the way that I feel about him, the way that he's playing right now. And it's not that I never thought Siakam was a good player. It's just my thoughts on how Siakam can be most effective are starting to change a little bit, right? Like, Fred VanVleet is one of my ultimate confidence players. I talk to you guys about this a lot, how there are certain players. I've watched sports through this lens a lot, is who do I feel comfortable with on the ice when the game is tight? Who do I feel comfortable with the ball in their hands when the game is tight? Who do I want making a play? Right? Who do I want? And for me, it's always been Fred. Fred. Give Fred the ball. Let Fred handle the ball. Let Fred make the decisions. I don't believe that anymore. And I know that you can say that's being reactionary or whatever. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with being reactionary to the way that Siakam is playing right now. I trust him the most to make the best decisions when he has the ball in his hand. I still think Fred is the guy I want taking the shot, Like, there's no question about that. I actually saw on the Raptors show with Will Liu, they had Justin Champagne, and he was a little outrageous. Justin Champagne, no offense. With his, I'd take Fred VanVleet over anybody in the NBA. Maybe, I think he said NBA history, maybe. I can't remember exactly which the framework was, over Steph. But I don't think it's that outrageous in the context of the NBA that Fred would be one of the top guys that we'd want with that shot, because I believe he's clutch, and I've seen him do it in the playoffs. So I still believe that Fred is this team's identity from a play standpoint. But Siakam is just really taking over as the team's best player. And the Raptors are such a funny team to watch, because I still care about who's playing what position, because I grew up with the game where positions matter, right? But it's just this constant juggling of who is what position at what time. And I find that... But that's what I mean. But it's so fun to watch them do this, where you go, okay, who's playing what? And sometimes Fred's on the floor, and I'm thinking, are you even the point guard right now? I don't think you're the point guard right now. I don't think that you're actually, in my terminology of trying to break this thing down, that that's what you are. And Siakam's ability right now to just play multiple positions, to handle the ball that way, not turning the ball over with that kind of volume. I don't know what his usage percentage, Blake, was, but he touched the ball a lot. He had 10 assists, duh. So to have zero turnovers is wildly impressive, especially against a tough, ball-hungry team like the Heat that's not just going to give things up easily. I'm not trying to use hyperbole, because I think that happens too often with Siakam and it ends up hurting him. I don't think that he's some kind of like otherworldly player now, but I do think that the evolution of his game towards more playmaking is something that is really important for this team if they're going to make the pieces that they have work and if he's going to be a part of this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the common thread in what we've been talking about as Fred had that scoring burst, as Pascal has come along as a playmaker, is that obviously neither one of those guys is a true 1A star, right? So what do they need for this team to be good? It's they need both of them to be at this level, and they need to play off each other the way they have. You mentioned the clutch stats, JD, or your clutch feel. Fred's 11 of 22 on threes in clutch situations. That's like...
He was very clutch for me hitting that over 19.5 prop with that three last night. I'll tell you what. It was very clutch.
That's a monster stat line. He's not finishing super well, so you look, hey... Well, maybe you need you need someone who can get to the rim. Well, Pascal's 9 of 16 inside the arc in the clutch. So you have a couple different ways to approach it there. Obviously, you have Gary Trent and OG kind of spotting up around that when everyone's healthy too. And that Siakam VanVleet action that I mentioned yesterday, however you set up the ball handler and the screener, continues to deliver pretty good returns for them. So, you know, let's go back to December 31st, which is when everyone kind of returned from COVID. Siakam and VanVleet have shared the court for 317 minutes, which is a pretty good chunk of time. The Raptors have a plus 8.3 net rating in that time. Basically, if those two guys are on the court, and at this point, the sample is enough that, yes, they've played some undermanned teams and stuff like that, but they've also played like Phoenix and Milwaukee and Miami, Milwaukee twice. So there's some real teams in there, Philly. They are, whenever those two are on the floor, and you can expand it to include OG if you'd like, because the numbers are just as good. If they have their core on the floor, they are winning the minutes that those guys are out there. So,
sorry, you said core on the floor, and it made me think of boar on the floor.
Yeah. So when there's a boar on the floor, Raptors are getting lots of sausage. Yeah, lots of sausage. It's reductive to say like, hey, when their best players are playing really good, they're winning. But their best players are also beating the other team's best players. Now the question becomes, well, how the hell do you not rely on those guys? Like, they played a six-man rotation last night, and that's going to be, you know, you talk about clutch performance and stuff. These guys can't be this gassed by the end of a game.
When you talk about best players, where does Chris Boucher rank in your rankings lately? He's been slowly making his way up there. I know we talked about a week ago how he had stood out and he's done well, but he's been kind of consistent. Is he someone that you're like still impressed with, or is this where he's kind of settled in the rankings?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still impressed with him. I think he's been really good of late. I don't think he's like fundamentally changed where I think he is for this team. Like, he's still a 29-year-old pending free agent. And I still think, you know, it's always funny with trade talk, because once you hit a certain level of good, no one wants to trade you. And once you get below that certain level, everyone wants to trade you, but your value would be less. And Boucher's a fun experiment with that. But Boucher's another guy that, like, we can expand the sample a little bit here, and he's been pretty good, like 13-8 over his last 18, shooting 50% from the floor. So the three-point shooting is still not really there, last couple games aside. But, yeah, he's a guy who's rediscovered his niche, right? And it's, you know, you talk about role certainty and stuff. You probably don't want to play Boucher 38 minutes like you did last night because you have only six guys that you're trusting. But Boucher as the energy bench big obviously fits him. And whether that's alongside Precious or in replacement of Precious, you know, he's kind of rediscovered his role and is back to playing within it.
It's funny because, again, because you have those pieces, those interchangeable guys, like the way that Siakam is playing right now really opens up your lineup flexibility to have multiple bigs playing at the same time, right? It just works. Same thing with Fred. Those are just two pieces that your roster makes sense when they're on the floor. It's workable when they're on the floor. Scotty Barnes, another one. I thought Scotty Barnes, for a guy that what was his like actual field goal percentage last night? It must have been pretty low. But
not good. 6 of 18. No.
But I was going to say, for a guy that shot 6 of 18, I thought that he had actually a really solid game and that he was really noticeable in a lot of other ways. And again, because he's just someone who I believe is so fluid in what you can ask of them to do that it fits with other pieces around them. But I'm shocked at how effective at times I've thought the look is when they go big like that and when they're playing Boucher and Precious Achiuwa, two guys that I have not historically been very high on individually, and how it's still working for them. But a quick thought on Boucher. One is, I think that he actually has real role chemistry with Siakam. Like, Siakam knows where to look for him in the role game. And it's something where I don't know if you can get a player that is better for this year with Chris Boucher, but it's gone just about as good as it could have possibly gone over this stretch in terms of him becoming a trade chip. Because I've always had questions as to whether or not Boucher can be a winning player, as in someone who buys into something that is greater than himself. And he still has those moments, right? He still loves to chuck, and he is not shy with his trebuchet three-point shot. And there are times where the decision-making, you know, even going to the basket, you think, God, man, what are you doing? But his intensity on the offensive glass, his intelligence rolling to the rim right now, his capability of shooting a three, and just the buy-in that he has given the Raptors ever since the benching. If I'm another team around basketball right now, if I'm somebody who is in need of that position, he is answering a bunch of questions for me, and he is absolutely worth a shot. And I'm sorry because, yeah, I don't care, Raptors fans. If you don't think that the Raps should be shopping Chris Boucher, you're too close to the situation. He needs to be on the trading block. He absolutely needs to be on the trading block. The Raptors, 100%, they can do two things at once. They can try and add a piece to help them now, but they should absolutely be looking to move Chris Boucher for a piece that should be here longer term, because it's really, really hard to envision how you're bringing him back unless you're doing something drastic like moving off of one of the other bigs, and I just don't see how that's a possibility. Like, you'd have to give up something, right, to get off that Kem Birch contract at this point, given the injuries and the knee. And you just traded for Precious Achiuwa. He's younger. He's more controllable. Tough to envision that spot, right? Like, this still feels like Boucher is being showcased.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in, like, showcasing. I think Boucher's playing a lot because they need him to play a lot, and he's one of the only guys that they trust right now. It just so happens he's playing well enough that you could consider it him showcasing himself. But yeah, he's 29. He's a pending free agent. He only makes $7 million. So in terms of making that work in trade scenarios, it's really easy. He's the most tradable guy on the team. Yeah. In terms of, do you have a market and is it easy to find a workable trade? Yeah, I guess the only argument would be is, like, if you're the Raptors and you are seeing these Precious Boucher minutes or these Precious Kem minutes, and JD, you said that you're impressed with them. Well, when they have two of those guys on the floor, Boucher, Precious, and Kem, they are rolling teams. And that's not, like, that's mostly against opposing bench units, and there's some garbage time there, so don't take it too strong. But, like, they're winning those minutes, and that suggests, like, another way to frame that is they're winning the minutes where Chris Boucher is playing a quote-unquote power forward role instead of a center role. So if they believe in that and they think that they can get Boucher via his bird rights, you know, back at a reasonable salary, maybe they don't want to move off of it. But it's hard to see them spending the limited money they're going to have this offseason on re-upping Chris Boucher. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I hate to do the every time a guy has a good game, try to flip him thing, but we're 3.5 weeks out from the trade deadline.
That's not
this. Is no, I know. I know. I'm not saying it's you. I'm saying
I'm saying you. I'm saying that you are not doing that. Like, Blake, this is the conversation around Boucher. Yeah. Is he's playing really well and he's heading into the deadline. Like that. Yeah. This is going to continue to be
a thing.
We're
3.5 weeks out. So,
yeah, just over his last 10 games, he's still a 6'11" guy, 6'10". How tall is 6'9"? I don't know.
6'9". I don't know.
Sure, he's in that
range. It's the Raptors, man. You just pick whatever height you want, and people are supposed to believe it.
Yeah, he's playing well, but he's still a big that over his last 10 is shooting under 50% from the field, and he's
under 30% on threes.
Under 30% on threes. I still don't love the efficiency of the player overall. And when I talk about showcasing, yeah, you're right. I don't think that the Raptors have the luxury of doing that right now. And it's pretty clear they're not doing that because they're only playing six guys. Like, if any team was going to be accused of showcasing, they'd probably be dead last.
Yeah, but poor Malachi can't even get a showcase minute in garbage time. So
I actually hate what they're doing with Malachi at this point. It's really starting to bother me.
It's not even just Malachi. And this was, honestly, Ailish, you teed it up as what do I take from this game? And there are these positives with Siakam and Boucher, but I'm pretty frustrated with, a six-man rotation. Champagne played 9 minutes last night, sure. He also, bad sign when
his poor thumb or his finger.
The guy on a two-way contract dislocates his finger and he's still the guy you go to as the seventh man because you don't trust anyone. And even last night after the game, Nick Nurse kind of defended him. He's like, yeah, Utah's a guy I could see getting back in the rotation at some point. It's like, okay, well, if neither Malachi or Delano have any chance of getting the rotation, the 905 are right there. Mm-hmm. Get them down there so they're at least developing. Mm-hmm. Svi, I'm not going to be too upset with him not getting rotation minutes anymore. But this is a game in January. Like, I don't know. The six-man rotation thing is a bit much right now.
Well, so I don't know how else you're supposed to interpret it other than the Raptors have given up on Malachi Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, you could get him for a mid-second at this point, I'm pretty sure. Like, right. the Matt Thomas and Terrence Davis trades from last trade deadline where, hey, here are picks in the 40s that there's not a huge difference between that and grabbing a guy on the undrafted free agent market. Like, that's what you could probably get Malachi for at this point.
I got to say, too, I know that we can be homers a little bit, but I watch a lot of basketball, Blake. You watch a lot of basketball. Malachi Flynn has looked lost at times. He's definitely been a mistake-prone player. I've thought that he's someone who really struggled coming into the NBA, going from a very heavy role where he was established and somebody that, hey, he needs volume, he needs touches, he needs the ability to make mistakes, and that the Raptors actually hurt. That experience actually hurt him of, hey, if you have a bad game on this team or you have some bad minutes, you're going to hit the bench. And to me, it looked like he really lost his confidence here. But I still do see NBA quality skills from him. Like, this isn't somebody where when he's on the floor, I go, oh my God, he's just completely lost. He doesn't belong in this league. And I've felt that with other players before. And I felt that with other players who've got more minutes than him before. And I honestly can't make sense of why there wouldn't be 7 minutes a night for this guy. You know, why there wouldn't be six. Like, honest to God, 7, 8, 9 minutes. You can't carve that out for this guy just to try and like, it's got to be something beyond basketball, right? Like, what is your understanding of the situation outside of just what he does on the floor?
I don't think it's beyond basketball because look at, they're doing, like, they're not playing anyone.
Yeah.
Like, they played six.
But the other guys have gotten shots.
Sure. Like, you know? Mean, yeah. Like, Malachi got 30 minutes in a game, not like, I mean, in the last month. But yeah. The other thing is that, like, so I agree with you. Like, I still think Malachi, like, if I'm another team, absolutely I'm taking a flyer on Malachi as a bench guard to see if you can get that stuff to click. Like, he's obviously an established pick and roll guy. You know, there's the makings of a defensive point guard there. But he's been pretty bad when he's played this year. And he is,
I mean, he's averaging 4 minutes a game or something stupid like that.
9 minutes a game, yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
The other thing is, and I know, you know, maybe you don't put a ton of stock in this as a guy's going up and down and playing random games. He got benched for an entire fourth quarter in a 905 game the other day, and the team, like, took off without him and did this big comeback. And he has not looked very good down there either. So I agree with you. I think it's probably at this point, like, it's in his head a little bit, and there's been this, hey, we drafted you, and this is the type of point guard you are, and this is how you've been so successful, and now we want you to play a completely different style. Yeah. I think there's an element of that, and we talked early in the season when Delano first kind of usurped him, and it was like, hey, you know, you don't retool what your second unit looks like so that a sophomore backup point guard gets comfortable. But they have asked Malachi when he's gotten these minutes this year to play a pretty uncharacteristic style for him. So yeah, I think his time as a Raptors rotation guy is probably coming to an end. The rotation guy stuff is at an end. I wouldn't be surprised if he's still on the roster past the deadline, because maybe just no one offers anything. But like, they're going to get offers of a second round pick for Malachi as a Flyer. Like, he's got one cheap year left on his deal, and then a team option for another. I think he's a fresh start candidate.
Yeah, I agree. And hopefully I think that if you're the Raps right now, one of the goals of the deadline, and I know we're going to talk deadline for the next 3 weeks, but one of them right now for me is just, yeah, kind of seeing if you can find moves like that where you're trading Malachi Flynn for a second, but then maybe you're using that second round pick and rerouting it somewhere else for a player that maybe you think is buried somewhere else that you'd like to try out, and that you'd like to see.
That's a challenge trade.
Yeah, exactly. So give me some moves like that. I'm not expecting something major. Again, I would guess that the Raptors' biggest trade is going to be Boucher out the door, if possible. And then outside of that, that's all I'm looking for, is try to find some pieces, try to go find some guys that can elongate this bench a little bit, because yeah, I don't think that this is really sustainable, what they're doing with six guys. I know that's not really a hot take. Like, you got to play more than six guys, or an interesting take. You got to play more than six guys in a basketball game if you're going to play out an entire regular season. But yeah, I don't like the wear and tear on some of these guys right now. Last thing from me anyways. Oh, do you have something else on that?
No, I was just, I was going to use that as a pivot for something to chew on. Do your other thing first, and then we'll pivot back to chew.
I just want to say this one thing, because it is something that I'm really monitoring, and I am flagging it when it happens, and it's probably going to be annoying, but I'm going to keep doing it anyways. It was another game where OG didn't fit. It was another game where I thought to myself, all these pieces are kind of clicking together, and I like the way that these guys are playing together, and when OG had the ball, it felt like, again, independent of the team, and independent offensively anyways of the group. And to me, it still feels this way, where OG seems to be the guy that's struggling to find himself in this reality. And I don't really know. Again, I know what he is as a spot-up shooter. I know that he can bully his way to the basket sometimes, but looked lost again to me last night. Looked like a guy that really just didn't know where he's supposed to be or what he's supposed to be doing on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'm not there with you, man. I think, you know, we've looked at these Fred and Pascal stretches and just how good they've been. OG has like very quietly averaged 19 points a game, really efficient, like pretty efficiently over this same stretch of time. I think his role has changed again for sure. Like, he's back to being a more traditional three A/3B with Gary Trent Jr. And his usage has come down a little bit, but he's still using 23% of possessions over this stretch where you know, over the season, but also over this stretch where the other guys have been a little hotter and a little more ball dominant. And the truth is so again, I've said this before, is that like, it's almost a credit to OG that they trust him to change his role up like this and play different roles. He's been more efficient during this stretch. And then the thing is like, if Gary Trent is out, OG is your only non-Fred shooter. So you almost have to, as a matter of how you line your offense up, have to have OG spotting up a little bit more than you'd like, maybe, because no one else can shoot the ball.
No, I actually like when he's spotting up. I actually like that, and I think that that is the better role. The times where I see that it looks uncomfortable is where it feels like he's trying to insert the other parts of his game into the offense. And those are the times where
it feels lost. Yeah, I mean, I know that clutch play last night is standing out to you, right? He takes, I think it was Caleb Martin or Gabe Vincent, he tries to take him down into the post, and he has the first move, but no second layer moves. I don't think, like, big picture, even this five-game stretch where Trent's been out, he's at 24% usage. It's, like, I don't know. Things are going to ebb and flow when you're the third or fourth guy in the offense. And I think the bigger question is
confusing the conversation here, though. Like, it's not that I think that he's not getting enough or that he should be in some way worked in more. I actually feel like when he's playing on offense and he has the ball in his hands in anything other than a catch and shoot situation, that it looks like he plays with the teammates on offense. I hate saying this, but the worst. Like, he looks like the guy to me where it's a bit of a black hole. Like, that usage percentage doesn't shock me because the ball goes into him, and I kind of go, okay, well, that's where it's going to die. Or if it gets out of his hands, it ends up being kind of late in the shot clock, and he doesn't end up putting guys in really advantageous situations. It's like a kick out. It just doesn't look comfortable to me. His offense doesn't look like it's something that's coming easy outside of those, hey, here's the ball, you're open, shoot it. Whenever he has to put the ball on the deck, it never really looks right now like he knows what he's going to actually be doing with it and that his body is ahead of what his brain is doing.
Yeah, and I mean, like, this is when we were early in the season and the preseason when, you know, one of the talking points, especially when Siakam was out, was, hey, give OG more touches. Let's see what's there with OG. OG. Part of the discussion was, hey, he's got to work through this stuff. Like, he doesn't have a great handle yet. He doesn't have counter moves yet. So now you're seeing it in a smaller role where the team has performed to a 500 level. So and Siakam's back, so it no longer feels as comfortable having those 4 or 5 OG possessions a game where it's like, look, he's going to freelance as a matter of development. And I think that's why, like, the circumstances he's doing this stuff within have changed. We have to take a break so that we can get to Marcus Spears on the other side. But quickly, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. JD, you kind of mentioned it. The Raptors used 6 guys last night plus Justin Champagne for 9 minutes. That's okay once in a while. Look at the old leaderboard. Fred VanVleet, 1st. Pascal Siakam, 7th. OG Anunoby, 9th. Scottie Barnes, 12th. That is the minutes per game leaderboard, the NBA. For the top 12, Gary Trent comes in at 41 as well. I know that right now the Raptors need to win basketball games because they're in the play-in bubble and they're right around 500 and they need to stack some wins to make up for the shakier parts of the season. But something that you want is you might have to take the lumps of playing some of these depth guys you don't trust as much because, man, 4 guys in the top 12 for minutes per game is a tough one. We're going to take a break. When we come back, it's Marcus Spears, NFL and NBA analyst on ESPN, co-host of the Swagoon Perk podcast. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan. J.D. Bunkus, Ailish Borfar, Blake Murphy. It's Text Line Tuesday, so fire away. Whatever you want, you're the producer. 590, 590. You can also hit us up on our socials. J.D. Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Ailish Borfar, Twitter and Instagram. We're checking the DMs. Ailish already asking people what the coldest rink in Ontario is.
Oh, lots of responses on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, you know that's going to cause real blood feuds. That's going to end up getting some real old school replies from people. We're going to connect here with Marcus Spears. We're just seeing if we have the good line here. Marcus Spears, NFL and NBA analyst for ESPN, co-host of NFL Live and co-host of the Swagoo and Perk podcast. Marcus, how's it going, man?
What's going on? How y'all doing this morning?
Good, man. Good. I mean, like, trying to kind of parse through how we're supposed to feel about that Kyler performance. And I'll start with this. Did the way he played fundamentally change the way that you feel about him?
No, it didn't. I think the way he played was a reflection of coach and how it looked from an standpoint. When you think about last night, us watching that game, and we actually did a mega cast on my NFL Live crew. And I just could not for the life of me understand why you wouldn't use Kyler Murray's most devastating tool. And that's his athleticism. Again and again, drop back. Again and again, hand the ball off in the middle of the line of scrimmage and gain like 3 yards. And then after halftime, you see the tempo. You see Kyler start to get on the edge, start to extend plays, use his leg. And it's something I watch with the Dallas Cowboys too. And it's mind-boggling that you have these coaches or these so-called gurus or boy geniuses that cannot adapt to what's happening to them in the game. And in turn, your quarterback, offensive line, your receiver, everybody looks bad. Cliff Kingsbury had the worst night last night, not Kyler Murray.
Marcus, we're going to just try to reconnect with you here for a second because we got a bit of a tough line. But I really like that answer. Hopefully we can get Marcus back. It's a player's answer, right? It's a player defending a player. Mm-hmm. What I hope we get to ask Marcus is how much of that he does view as the coaching, because that's part to me. That's I'll admit it. I don't know all of those things. I don't have the intricacies, but he used the Cowboys as an example. And when I watch Dak Prescott, I always think, like, why doesn't Dak take off more? Not that it isn't something that's designed for him enough. And that's sort of how I felt with Kyler yesterday, is like there were a lot of opportunities for Kyler Murray to run, and he didn't mm-hmm. do it. And whether it was just the way that he could run outside of the pocket and try to deliver a throw, like, I didn't see those things. I didn't see Kyler use his own legs or him try to make those decisions. And, like, I don't know. I guess just from my vantage point, it didn't seem as much like that was a coaching decision as, like, that was a Kyler decision.
Yeah, but maybe, I mean, to Marcus's point about, you know, hey, so much of the action was just him on dropbacks and him in the middle of the field. Like, they didn't have him moving Signed to start legs. Possessions right off the snaps and, like, mm-hmm. get him at it. Like, we can ask Marcus more. Like, he's a former defensive end. Like, he knows, hey, what's the toughest thing to defend against with a quarterback that's dynamic like that? So, yeah, maybe the threat of a Kyler run. Like, he broke that one off. That one runoff at one point to get a first down, but that's about it, and that was on a broken play. So that's something we could probably ask Marcus about, is, you know, if you're a defense, did Arizona make it simpler for you?
Well, yeah, he's back on the line now. So, yeah, Marcus, okay. We were just asking about Kyler Murray. It seems like, yeah, you're laying more of the blame at the feet of the coaching staff. And when you're saying that, though, because, like, we were just discussing it, how it didn't look like Kyler wanted to take off in a lot of situations. Like, it didn't look like he wanted to use that weapon, his legs, which was pretty surprising to a lot of people. Is that something where you feel like they should have just been designing more bootlegs? They should have been designing more just quarterback runs off the... Like, what is it that you were looking for from the coaching staff to better utilize his legs?
Yeah, exactly what you just said. Bootlegs, get them on the outside, giving them a two-way go, an option, the zone reads that they run, the RPOs that they run. It just, I mean, anybody watching that game just saw how stagnant it was. It was straight drop back. So many times, Kyler looking down the field, nothing's there. And it's just weird to me, man, when you have – look, Kyler's most dynamic ability is to extend plays and be an athlete. Don't get it wrong. I think he's a quarterback that can throw from the pocket. He can do all of those things. But ultimately, when you get to this point in the season where you won and done, I need all your tools. And I need your most effective tool. And I also need to use the tool that's going to make the defense worry more than anything about who we are as an offense. And I just didn't see that. And Kyler's unwillingness to run. You know, I thought about this because I was talking about Dak and why he wouldn't take off. But these guys are so programmed to go through their progressions. When you get a play call in the huddle, you go through your progressions, and you're trying to push the ball downfield because that's what the play is calling to do. And I think sometimes when you do that over and over again and you got tight coverage and you're thinking about Aaron Donald and Von Miller and Leonard Floyd, your path to just taking off on a broken play, per se, because the pass concept didn't work, is not as simple as when we watching it from home. That's why you have to get the design runs. That's why you have to create his opportunities to get on edges and throw the ball from a different angle. And it just wasn't enough of that. And I think the one that he scrambled on was a straight drop back. And he got out for, like, I think, like five or 6 yards. And I'm thinking to myself, well, where's the quarterback draw to get a running back to lead up through the hole and Kyler follow through? Or where's your RPO when we saw them operating at a high level? And I just didn't think from a challenge the defense standpoint, it was enough nuance and enough, like, difference in play calling.
So if you're putting a little bit more onus of this on Kingsbury, we outlined earlier that he's got a little bit of a history of second half collapses, extending all the way back to 2013. So my question for you is, what's next for him? If you're making a decision on whether to keep him, does the amount of head coach vacancies throughout the league make you a little bit more hesitant to make a rush decision because it's kind of a musical chair situation? Or does that give you more incentive because a top coach might want to come to Arizona because there's potential with the quarterback?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, one, you evaluate, because we are still sitting here talking about a team that made the playoffs. That's number one. You got to factor that in, and it's hard to just, you know, are you replacing it for 3 to 4 more wins? But ultimately, I think what these ownership groups and what general managers and decision makers in these franchise and organizations are looking at is, do we believe this guy? This is going to be Cliff question, and it's probably one that if it becomes difficult to answer, you do move on. Is Cliff the guy to take this team to the next level in regards to when those type of moments present themselves again, will they be prepared? Will they look inept? I think the biggest indictment on Cliff in this game is that he got so outcoached, and Sean McVay going to be there. Kyle Shanahan is still going to be there. So I think when you weigh it, I think you weigh it against, all right, do we really feel like this guy in our particular division can get us to the point where we win our division and we get into the playoffs consistently? And based on last night, I don't think you answer that question with a yes. And I think that's the decision that the brass in Arizona is going to have to make. Because when you look at this division, obviously, Seattle is in flux and trying to figure out what they're going to do with Pete Carroll and if Russell Wilson is going to be there. But ultimately, like, Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan, you know those are elite play callers. Kyle Shanahan just went to Dallas and won, and we saw what McVay was able to do against Arizona in that defense. So I think you're weighing it more against your division. I probably would move on if I was making the decision, because I've seen enough sample size of Cliff Kingsbury at this point to know that this is his MO. Like, we gotta believe people when they show us who they are.
So the Cowboys made that same coaching change 2 years ago after kind of running into the same wall over and over again. Big step forward in the regular season here, but that disappointing outcome the other day. If you could make one change during the offseason for the Cowboys, what would it be? Because they don't have the change coaches bullet to use. They don't, you know, they're locked into Dak. So what are you looking to change if you're the Dallas Cowboys?
For me, it's probably re-solidifying this offensive line. And I know that's, like, tough to say. Tyron Smith is starting some of the kinks and injuries and body wise are starting to show. I still think he's a good tackle. You look at Connor Williams, the guard on this offensive line, he just got whooped all season long. That's really what it boils down to. You start there. As far as coaching, I'm not in the school of getting rid of McCarthy. I sent off a tweet about get rid of the coach. I was talking about Kellen Moore. I thought he was in the same vein in which we just talked about Cliff Kingsbury in that game. That's why we got to be so super careful in ordaining these guys the next one. And I know Kellen is about to get interviews and all of that, but there was nothing about that plan in a playoff game where I was like, oh, yeah, this offensive coordinator that can take somebody to a Super Bowl. I just didn't get it. And the numbers, like that's what people will say. They'll throw the numbers up. Oh, look at the Cowboys' offense and what they were able to do. The bottom line is you feasted on a lot of bad defenses. That's number one. The other thing, too, is we should start judging these offensive coordinators and these so-called great play callers like we judge quarterbacks in their playoff moments. What was your performance like when it was all on the line? And I just don't think that Kellen Moore stepped up to the table. And that's not to protect Mike McCarthy. He has his issues as well. But when you take a team to 12-5, it's hard to justify getting rid of you as a head coach. But from an offensive standpoint, they struggled for a while this season on offense. And I'm not sure if that's something that I would, you know, necessary. And I know Kellen, Jerry loves Kellen, and he kept him. He was a holdover from the staff. That's a whole other issue we could get into. But I would probably look to make that change. If it's a football-specific on the field, I'm going to probably try to reinvigorate this offensive line. We're getting old up there. But if it's a coaching thing, man, I gotta either challenge Kellen more to be more creative and step up, or I gotta figure out how I can get an offensive coordinator to use all of the talent that Jerry Jones says this team has, and a lot of people believe they have. But when you got CeeDee Lamb with one catch in a playoff game, when you got Tony Pollard with six total touches, probably your most dynamic your most dynamic back, because Zeke was dealing with an injury. It's unjustifiable as an offensive mind and a guru, quote unquote, that two of your best players touched the ball a total of seven times in the entire NFL football game, when it never was really – the doors wasn't blown off Dallas like that for them to get away from trying to get their playmakers the ball. So I would look to see if we could upgrade the OC spot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that a lot of people would echo the sentiment from the vantage point of, like, for me, it's Dallas has been building their entire team around this identity of, well, they've got all these weapons and they've got all these players and they're going to be able to have this and they're going to have that. And yet, every time I watch them play a good team, I don't feel like the offense is special. And I'll admit that for me. I'll admit for me, like, I agree with you, the offensive line, like, that was once the identity. When Dak first came in, it was, man, this is the best offensive line in football, and they can push anybody, and they can push them forward, and they're going to let Zeke run, and then Dak's just going to be able to make the plays that he's just going to be able to make. I think, though, that there is a secondary part of this, which is, okay, listen, they're not going to move off of Dak Prescott, but do you think that he is the type of quarterback who can basically elevate a team around him, or do you think that he is closer to, like, that game manager quarterback where, yeah, he does need the better quarterback, coordinator. He does need the perfect game plan. He does need the better offensive line, because I think a lot of people would argue that there is a lot at his disposal right now.
Yeah, I think he's a guy that can elevate, but I don't think he's a guy that's going to elevate you in the vein of, let's say, Aaron Rodgers or Russell Wilson when he was doing it his day. And you know, when you look at Dak's career, it's very, like, you got both sides of the argument, right? You got, well, he's only won this amount of playoff games, and look at his numbers, look what he did in this game. But ultimately, when you look at football, like, and I tell people, man, the antithesis of that is, we watched the Rams last night. Into the fourth quarter, Matthew Stafford was 11 for 15, 157 yards, two touchdowns, and a rushing touchdown. Now, if we open up the stat sheet at the end of the game, you look at, you say, Matthew Stafford had 157 yards passing, and they won 34-11. Well, we're not going to write home about we're going to say Matthew Stafford had a phenomenal game. He managed it well. And when he needs to throw it 40 to 50 times, that's when you need to find out, you know, what these quarterbacks can do from an elevation standpoint. It's hard to judge, man, for me. And that's just like with Kyler last night, what I talked about with Cliff. It's hard to judge because this league is really built on play calling. Like, when we get to the offensive point, like, if you don't have a quarterback, we all know you ain't winning no games. And I don't know if I would, if you would have honestly put a poll together and asked people, do you feel like you can win games with and because of Dak Prescott? I would assume it would come back at a very high percentage of yes. And now when you answer that question, because we've seen it in real time with Dak, we've seen playoff comebacks, we've seen him have the 400-yard passing games and all of that. And he's done it consistently at a high enough level to earn a contract in, like he did in Dallas. I think he's a guy you can win because of. But when your offensive line is shaky, and when you don't have a play caller that's going to – think about this. This is the perfect example. What were we saying about Patrick Mahomes the first 6-7 weeks of the season? What is happening to the Chiefs offense? Why won't they run the football? What is Patrick seeing? He's not staying patient. They plan to keep everything in front of him. And Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy made a conscious decision to figure out nuance and how to get this offense to be explosive without Patrick Mahomes having to drop back and throw it 55 times. Now you see a complete offense, team that won 9 out of their last 10 games of the season. And in this first playoff game, we see against the Steelers defense that's good at times, bad at times, that he played from a level of comfort. That's play calling. I believe Dak, Dak is not Patrick Mahomes. That's not my point. I believe Dak, coupled with an offensive line and a play caller that's going to have a lot of nuance and balance and ability to adjust throughout games, is a quarterback you can win because of.
Again, we're talking to Marcus Spears, NFL and NBA analyst for ESPN, co-host of NFL Live and the Swagoo and Perk podcast. So you are a defensive player, and you are on that New England team. Do you think you have a future? Because I don't know what you do after a performance like that. It feels like this is a clean house moment. Like, what, Belichick's just going to take that in stride? What do you do if you're New England? Because this is part of your identity, is being Bill Belichick's prepared defense, prepared for any scenario. And you just had history against you. You couldn't get one punt. Just one punt. Couldn't do it. What happens in New England?
He's going to absolutely go through that roster and evaluate. probably going to break the Buffalo film down 100 times and figure out where he was hurt at. And really, you know, we look at earlier this year, we talked about Matthew Judon being the biggest free agency pickup. He was nowhere to be found in that game. And I got to credit Buffalo and Daboll. They did a phenomenal job of just keeping them off balance. They used a lot of others when it comes to wide receivers. The first game, it was Isaiah McKenzie. What a second game of the trilogy. It was Isaiah McKenzie, 100 yards, touchdown. This past game, you got Gabe Davis involved. You got Cole Beasley. But the most important thing they did was got the run game going. And Belichick has always struggled with athletic quarterbacks. Always. Josh Allen decided, like, my legs will be super effective in this game. And ultimately, that broke the New England Patriots defense down, because when you added that into the game and when you added that nuance, and he saw, like, hey, we're having a hard time dealing with this quarterback run, and now you're given the illusion as Buffalo of quarterback run, it just puts you in a very difficult spot. So I think he will. You know, I think he'll look for – JC isn't going anywhere, one of the top corners in the league. I think he'll look for some linebackers to get younger. I know that sounds crazy. I think he'll look to get younger at linebacker, a little more speed, having to deal with Josh Allen now. And then from a defensive line standpoint, like, their pass rush was abysmal outside of Matthew Judon. So I think he's going to look for some more air rush, some guys that can get after the quarterback, you know, third down situations particularly, because Buffalo had their way. Josh Allen played from such a level of comfort in the pocket. It was just ease of travel. And I think one thing Bill Belichick has always done, it's taken away, you know, what you do best. And this was one of the first times where it's like, you can't take away anything. Everything is working. So, yeah, it'll be some major changes in New England, and he'll figure out how to try to defend against these guys in the division. That's his focus. It's like, okay, Buffalo, number one team in the division. What do they do well? And how can I get the personnel that I feel best with to stop it? And I think this year was a rude awakening for him about where Josh Allen is and his maturation process and what he may need to do in order to try to combat that. So, yeah, I expect to see some changes personnel-wise defensively.
As a Bills fan, this is music to my ears. Thanks for joining us this morning, Marcus. Appreciate it. And for reconnecting a few times.
Right,
appreciate
care.
You making time for us.
Yeah, no problem. Take care, guys. Appreciate it.
Awesome. See you, Marcus.
Marcus Spears, NFL and NBA analyst on ESPN and co-host NFL Live and co-host of the Swagoo and Perk podcast. Man, he's a busy guy.
That was what an answer for you, Ailish.
Ooh, Walmart. I'm sitting there just licking my chops.
He's like, yeah, and Belichick always struggles with this kind of quarterback, and it's a rude awakening, and he's got to try to retool his defense for this. That is the ultimate sign of respect. And it's the one that the Bills have shown the Chiefs, and why it's going to be so fascinating to see what happens this weekend, is they designed their team in part to beat the Chiefs. And how many moves are the Patriots going to make this offseason that are going to be with beating the Bills in mind? acknowledging that the Bills are the team, that the Bills have the quarterback, and that New England is the one that has to make the ultimate adjustment. But he's dead right on that. It's like, their front seven looks slow and weak, and even if they could have caught Josh Allen, it didn't look like they were pulling him down when he had a head of steam. I love that. That was a great. I really like Spears. That was really, really fun. Great job by our producer, Daniele, getting him. It very much reminded me of every conversation I've had with every single one of my Cowboys fans friends, though, where they defend Dak to the hilt. And it's like, it's the offensive line. It's Kellen Moore. It's Mike McCarthy. It's Amari Cooper not staying on the field. It's never Dak. It's Zeke. It's something. It's not enough to apologize. It's never quite Dak. I think it's a little bit Dak.
You know why they feel that way, Cowboys fans? It's just emotional damage. Emotional damage. They've been through it all. They just can't accept that. Mm-hmm. It's just sometimes you need to just clean it all out and start fresh.